Welcome to the History Maps podcast.
Glad to be here.
There is a brick cell, and it is barely 1 meter wide.
Right.
And maybe 2 meters deep.
Yeah.
You are sitting inside it, and it is freezing cold.
Yeah, completely exposed to the elements.
Exactly. You have a few wooden planks. During the day, they serve as a crude desk, and at night, they become a really hard bed. You have a bucket for a toilet, and you are trapped in this open-air booth for up to 3 days and 2 nights.
It is intense.
And the guards who are patrolling the walls, they are under strict orders. If you succumb to the cold or the intense stress or some illness and you die inside this cell, they will not interrupt the proceedings to carry your body out through the main gate.
No, they absolutely will not.
They will simply wrap you on a straw mat and throw your body over the high compound wall. Now, this is not a maximum security prison. This is a job interview.
Yeah, it is a harrowing scenario. And yet, that was the reality for millions of people.
Over centuries.
Right, over centuries. I mean, we look at a modern professional licensing exam or, you know, a high-stakes college entrance test today.
Sure.
And we tend to assume that this kind of massive standardized testing is a product of the industrial age. We think of it as a modern bureaucratic invention designed to sort huge populations efficiently.
Like a 20th century concept.
Exactly. But the sources for this deep dive detail a system that engineered the concept of a massive standardized meritocracy centuries before the Industrial Revolution was even an idea.
We are looking at the imperial examination system of China, which is known as the Kiju. Our sources cover an immense 1,300-year history today.
It is a massive timeline.
Yeah, we're stretching from the Sui dynasty all the way to the late Qing dynasty. And the mission for this deep dive is to understand the mechanics of this system. We need to explore how a standardized test built an empire, how it fundamentally shaped the culture and social hierarchy of that empire, and ultimately how the sudden dismantling of that test directly contributed to the fall of a dynasty.
It is a foundational pillar of Chinese history.
So if you have ever felt the anxiety of sitting in a quiet room with a clock ticking down while your future hangs in the balance, you are participating in a legacy that the Chinese Empire engineered over a millennium ago.
To truly comprehend the scale of it and, well, the necessity of the Kiju, we can't just look at the tests themselves. We have to understand what the world looked like before the tests even existed.
Right. The baseline.
Yeah. We have to trace the origins and look at this fundamental shift in human organization. Basically, the transition from relying on bloodlines to relying on brain power.
Okay, let's establish that baseline. The sources point out that in pre-imperial China, specifically during the Zhou dynasty, which ran from roughly 1046 to 256 BCE, your place in the administration was dictated almost entirely by who your father was.
Purely hereditary.
Right. It was a classic system based on hereditary nobility.
So the overarching administrative framework of that era, it relied on feudal lords and aristocratic lineages. The governance of the realm was entrusted to a very, very close circle.
Was there any room for merit at all?
I mean, there were certainly some nascent elements of merit, like a local leader might recommend an individual who displayed particular talents, or there might be skill-based evaluations like archery contests. But the core structure was rigidly hereditary.
You inherited the job.
You inherited your position, you inherited your status, and most importantly, you inherited your authority over the land and the people on it.
But hereditary nobility presents a massive structural problem for anyone who is trying to run a unified empire.
Oh, absolutely.
It is like a corporate structure where the CEO has to rely on a board of directors, but all the board members inherited their seats. They control their own regional offices, and they do not actually care about the overarching company. They only care about enriching their own departments.
That is a really apt comparison. When appointments are hereditary, the local officials feel loyalty to their own family lineage.
Their local power base.
Right. They do not feel a strong allegiance to the central king or the emperor in the capital. Over time, this inevitable fragmentation leads to regional warlords accumulating power. It leads to deep administrative inefficiencies and constant internal conflict.
Because the central authority is always weak?
Exactly, because the local authority is completely entrenched by blood.
So we see the first major shift away from this during the Han Dynasty, which lasted from 206 BCE to 220 CE. The sources detail a system called the Chajuzi,
which translates to a recommendation and inspection system.
Right. Commandery governors were tasked with nominating candidates based on their moral virtue and their scholarship.
And this represents a really crucial transitional phase. The Han Dynasty recognized that simply inheriting a title did not automatically endow a person with the administrative competence needed to govern.
Especially for an empire that was growing so rapidly.
Right. It was a complex empire. They needed capable administrators. So they instituted specific quotas. A commandery governor might be required by the central court to nominate one individual, often designated formally as a filial and incorrupt candidate.
Filial meaning devoted to their parents and ancestors.
Yes, and they had to nominate one of these candidates for every 200,000 inhabitants in their jurisdiction.
Okay, it is a step in the right direction, but it is still largely based on reputation, right? And recommendation. That
Definitely.
means it still relies heavily on patronage networks. Like, if the governor likes you or if your family has influence with the governor, you get nominated.
It was heavily political, but the sources highlight a specific pivotal moment under Emperor Wen of Han. This is in 165 BCE. He implemented actual written tests to evaluate these recommended
Oh,
candidates.
interesting. So they couldn't just coast on the recommendation.
Right. These early tests assessed a candidate's grasp of Confucian texts and their ability to analyze policy issues. Now, it was not a fully standardized empire-wide system yet. It was an irregular practice at first,
But it set a precedent.
a vital precedent. He established the principle that a candidate should have to demonstrate their expertise via public discourse and written evaluation before being appointed to a palace role.
Evaluating what a person knows rather than strictly who they know.
Exactly. It was the very beginning of that.
But the formal initiation of the imperial examination system, like as a primary standardized recruitment tool, that comes much later.
Yes, centuries later.
It happens under the Sui Dynasty, which ruled from 581 to 618. The sources pinpoint Emperor Wen, specifically Yang Jian, and his successor, Emperor Yang. They formalized the exams in the year 605.
And their primary target with these exams was the aristocratic nine-rank system that had completely dominated the preceding centuries.
Why did they target the aristocracy so directly?
Well, the political motivations of the Sui emperors become very clear when you look at the mechanics of statecraft. That hereditary nine-rank system had allowed a handful of powerful aristocratic families to deeply entrench themselves in the region.
The warlord problem again.
Exactly. The Sui emperors recognized that to unify China and to actually maintain central control, they had to break the monopoly of these aristocratic families. So the merit-based examination was essentially a political weapon.
A weapon to centralize power.
Yes, wielded by the emperors.
So by requiring potential officials to pass a state-administered test, a test based on a specific curriculum designed by the state, the emperor could entirely bypass the old aristocratic families.
Precisely. The state could directly recruit capable administrators from a much broader pool. And most importantly, the primary loyalty of these new recruits would be to the throne that granted them their position and their salary.
Not to their own aristocratic bloodline.
Right. It was a masterful tool for ensuring both ideological conformity and administrative efficiency.
I have to stop and push back on the historical reality of this, though. We are talking about a radical shift in human organization, moving from a society structured around hereditary aristocracy to one structured around a scholarly meritocracy.
Yes.
But did this system actually eliminate the aristocracy? Or did it just force the existing wealthy aristocracy to hire private tutors and start studying for a test?
The sources indicate it was much more the latter, especially in the early centuries of the system. I mean, the exams did not immediately create some sort of egalitarian utopia. What the exams did was change the rules of engagement for the elite class. The old aristocratic families quickly realized that the landscape had shifted. To maintain their regional power and their access to officialdom, they could no longer rely solely on their pedigree.
They had to actually pass the test.
They had to dominate the preparation for these new exams.
Because studying the foundational text requires immense resources. You cannot just pick up a book in your spare time. You need abundant leisure time, you need access to rare and expensive texts, and you need highly educated private tutors.
Absolutely.
If you are a peasant farming rice from dawn until dusk, you simply do not have the physical time or the resources to memorize thousands of pages of philosophy.
So in the short term, the introduction of the exams heavily favored the already wealthy and established families. They had the capital to invest in this new form of educational competition.
But it did change things eventually.
It did. The mechanism itself, The hard requirement to pass a state-administered test created a crack in the door of the aristocracy. Over generations, it provided a formalized, legally recognized pathway for individuals from non-aristocratic backgrounds to enter the bureaucracy.
Provided they could somehow secure the educational resources.
Exactly. It planted the seed of a meritocracy, even if the soil was highly unequal at first.
And while the Sui dynasty planted that seed, their reign was incredibly short. They fell in 618. It was the subsequent Tang dynasty that took this concept, refined it, and turned it into a massive functioning bureaucracy.
Yeah, the Tang dynasty, which ruled from 618 to 907, is the era where we see the examination system vastly expanded and deeply integrated into the state apparatus.
This is under Emperor Taizong, right?
Yes, under Emperor Taizong, who initiated key administrative reforms starting in 627. The examinations became regular, triennial events administered formally by the Board of Rites.
The sources spend a significant amount of time highlighting the role of Wu Zetian as well. She was the female ruler who expanded the examination system significantly during her reign over the Wu Zi dynasty.
Her influence is a major point of scholarly focus, because she utilized the examination system with acute strategic intent.
How so?
Well, as a female ruler, she faced immense opposition from the established Tang aristocratic families. She needed a new base of power.
So she built one.
She did. She used the expanded exam system to recruit a completely new faction of bureaucrats who owed their careers and therefore their absolute loyalty directly to her.
Deliberately sidelining the old elites.
Exactly. It perfectly demonstrates the political utility of the Kiju. It could be leveraged to cultivate a loyal administrative class tied directly to the current sovereign.
Let us dive into the specific degrees that were established and formalized during the Tang era. If you are a candidate during this time, what exactly are you studying for? The two primary tracks the sources outline are the Mingjing and the Jinshi.
So the Mingjing translates roughly to Illuminator of Classics.
Okay.
This track primarily tested the rote memorization of foundational Confucian texts, such as the Analects. It was essentially a test of pure recall. A candidate had to demonstrate that they had perfectly internalized the core canons of the culture.
And then there was the Jinshi degree, which translates to presented scholar. This one was viewed as significantly more prestigious.
Oh, it was the elite tier. The Jinshi evaluated a candidate's ability in complex literary composition. This involved writing highly structured poetry and rhapsodies, but it also tested their capacity to write policy essays addressing practical matters of statecraft.
So it wasn't just reciting text.
Right. It tested not just memory, but analytical capability, rhetorical skill, and literary refinement. The administration needed people who could draft compelling edicts and synthesize complex information, not just recite ancient texts.
But the math on these exams is brutal. The sources note that out of thousands of applicants taking the tests, only 20 to 50 Jinshi degrees were awarded annually during the Tang period.
Yes.
That is an incredibly stringent filter. We're looking at pass rates well below 1 or 2%.
And the individuals who attained the Jinshi degree formed a very exclusive, powerful elite within the bureaucracy. They consistently dominated the highest advisory roles and the censorial positions within the government.
Which brings us to the Song dynasty, ruling from 960 to 1279. The Song took the Tang's established framework and fundamentally restructured it to handle a massive demographic increase. We see a five-fold increase in examination participation compared to the Tang.
The Song dynasty emperors faced this really complex challenge of governing an empire that was undergoing significant demographic and economic shifts. They relied on the examinations even more heavily than the Tang to staff their sprawling administration.
And to weaken any lingering aristocratic military power.
Yes, that was always a secondary benefit.
The most pivotal procedural innovation during the Song was introduced by Emperor Taizu in 973. He established the palace examination. Let us walk through the psychology of this because it is fascinating.
It really is. Prior to the palace examination, candidates took their final metropolitan exams in the capital, administered by high-ranking chief examiners.
Right.
When a candidate passed, they naturally felt a deep sense of gratitude and loyalty to this specific examiner who had passed them.
Of course.
And this human dynamic inadvertently created bureaucratic factions and powerful patronage networks within the government itself.
It is exactly like feeling indebted to the hiring manager who gave you your first big break in your career. You are going to support them in internal office politics.
Exactly. Emperor Taizu recognized the danger of these internal factions. So he disrupted that dynamic with a brilliant procedural change. He decreed that he, the emperor himself, would personally administer the final examination to all the graduates of the metropolitan level.
Wow, okay, so he inserts himself into the process.
Yes. The emperor would personally review the essays, and the emperor would personally rank the final candidates.
So the ultimate loyalty of the candidate shifts. The successful candidates, the new government officials, were now technically considered students of the emperor.
Right.
Their allegiance bypassed their local teachers, it bypassed the ministry examiners, and locked directly onto the throne itself. The emperor became the supreme examiner, validating their credentials.
It is a masterful piece of political engineering disguised as an educational reform.
It really is.
But, you know, to manage a system that is processing hundreds of thousands of candidates at the lower levels, the Song administration also had to engineer rigorous methods to maintain the integrity of the grading.
Because if the system is perceived as corrupt, the entire social contract collapses.
Precisely. The sources detail some incredibly intense anti-corruption methods invented during this time.
The logistics of fairness were complex. To prevent examiners from recognizing candidates and showing favoritism, the Song implemented anonymous grading. They stopped putting candidates' names on the exam papers.
They assigned a randomized numbering system to the scripts instead.
And they realized that even without a name, a highly educated examiner might recognize the specific calligraphy style or the handwriting of a prominent student.
Yeah, calligraphy is highly distinct.
So they went a step further. They instituted a massive logistical hurdle. They had an army of designated clerks recopy every single candidate's essay entirely in red ink before the examiners ever laid eyes on them.
So the examiners only graded the standardized red ink copies.
I look at this and I compare it to modern blind auditions in symphony orchestras. To eliminate bias, orchestras put up a physical screen so the judges can only hear the music, they cannot see the musician. The Song Dynasty was executing this concept with written exams centuries ago.
It was incredibly forward-thinking for the era.
But I have a major question here. If the grading was truly blind, if the essays are copied by clerks and the names are completely removed, how did regional biases still persist? The sources clearly note that the southern provinces came to completely dominate the examination results during the Song.
Well, blind grading eliminates interpersonal bias at the exact point of evaluation. The examiner cannot favor their nephew. But blind grading cannot eliminate the systemic economic advantages that exist prior to the candidate sitting for the exam.
The preparation phase.
Exactly. The southern provinces, particularly the regions around the Yangtze River Delta, were economically far more prosperous than the north during this time.
And wealthier regions have more resources for education.
Wealthier families and wealthier communities could afford to build better local academies. They could hire the most renowned, expensive tutors. They could afford to print and distribute more study materials.
It is a massive advantage.
It is. The candidates from the South were simply better prepared because their regional economy supported a robust, highly competitive educational infrastructure. The dominance of the South became so pronounced and politically sensitive that later dynasties, like the Qing, actually had to introduce strict regional quotas.
Like geographic quotas.
Yeah, such as mandating a 60-40 split of degrees between the South and the North, just to ensure that the northern and central regions maintained representation in the imperial government.
It perfectly illustrates the limits of procedural fairness. A standardized test can be completely blind in the grading room, but it still heavily reflects the deep economic inequalities of the society outside the room.
It always does.
Now, to keep this massive blind-graded system functioning across millions of people and spanning centuries of time, the state needed a perfectly standardized rubric. They needed every examiner and every candidate to know exactly what was being measured.
Which leads us directly to the curriculum.
And arguably the most infamous literary format in human history.
We're moving into the Ming and Qing dynasties now, a vast period spanning from 1368 all the way to 1912. During this era, the curriculum became rigidly standardized around Neo-Confucian orthodoxy.
Specifically, the interpretations formulated by the Song Dynasty philosopher Zhu Xi. We need to explain who this is and why his opinion mattered so much.
Zhu Xi is essentially the Thomas Aquinas of the Confucian tradition. He took the vast, sometimes contradictory body of ancient Confucian philosophy and synthesized it into a cohesive, highly structured orthodox system.
You organized it.
He did. He selected specific texts and wrote definitive commentaries on exactly how they should be interpreted. The imperial state eventually adopted Zhu Xi's specific interpretations as the absolute, unquestionable truth.
So no room for debate.
None. The core of the curriculum was narrowed down to what became known as the Four Books and the Five Classics.
The four books included foundational texts like the Analects and Mencius. The five classics included the Book of Songs, the Book of Documents, the Book of Rites, the Book of Changes, and the Spring and Autumn Annals.
Yes.
Mastery of these specific texts and strict adherence to Zushi's commentaries on them became the absolute requirement for any candidate hoping to pass. You were not allowed to offer a novel interpretation. You had to perfectly reflect the state-sanctioned orthodoxy.
And it was not just about the content of what you wrote. It was about exactly how you physically structured that content. This brings us to the Bagawin, famously known in English as the Eight-Legged Essay.
The sources provide a detailed breakdown of this format, and the requirements are incredibly intense.
The Eight-Legged Essay was a highly restrictive, formulaic style of writing that became mandatory for the metropolitan examinations from the early 15th century onward. It was designed to test a candidate's ability to expound on a passage from the classics with absolute structural precision.
Let us walk through the mechanics of this. It had eight distinct sections.
Right. A candidate had to craft an opening, followed by the amplification of the theme, then a preliminary exposition, the initial argument, the central argument, the latter argument, the final argument, and a formal conclusion.
And within that eight-part structure, there were strict requirements for parallel prose.
The legs of the essay, the core argument sections, had to perfectly balance each other in tone, rhythm, classical allusion, and even grammatical structure.
Wait, grammatical structure too?
Oh, absolutely. If you used a specific historical reference in one leg, you had to balance it with an equally weighty, structurally identical reference in the opposing leg. Furthermore, there were strict word limits, typically demanding between 500 and 700 characters. Depending on the specific prompt, there were even mandatory rhyming requirements.
The sources also mentioned that candidates were explicitly advised to avoid any offensive vocabulary and to rigorously eliminate any stylistic clues that might indicate their own identity, their region, or their social status.
It was the ultimate exercise in stylistic conformity. As a candidate, you are not being asked to provide a creative solution to a contemporary administrative problem.
Right.
You are being asked to demonstrate your flawless internalization of classical wisdom mapped onto a mathematically rigid literary grid.
My immediate analogy here is the modern five-paragraph essay taught in high school today. You have your introduction and your three-body paragraphs, your conclusion. It is a strict formula designed to teach students basic structure and thesis support.
Yeah, that's a good parallel.
But the eight-legged essay is that concept taken to an absolute extreme, and it has the stakes of a lifetime career, social status, and family honor attached to it. I want to challenge this format, though.
Okay.
Later 19th century reformists viciously attacked the eight-legged essay. They claimed it caused China's cultural stagnation and economic backwardness because it forced the brightest minds to focus on structural trivia rather than real-world problems.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair assessment, or is it a misunderstanding of what the bureaucracy was actually trying to achieve?
It is a debate that historians continue to analyze. On one hand, the critics have a very strong point. The format forced millions of young men to spend decades memorizing ready-made essays and prioritizing rigid structural conformity over practical problem solving.
Right, it directed all that intellectual energy
toward ancient philology and poetic meter, rather than empirical science, engineering, or modern governance. It created a pervasive culture of rote memorization.
It sounds like an intellectual straitjacket.
It was. However, if you look at it strictly from the perspective of the imperial administration trying to manage a continent-sized empire, the eight-legged essay was a highly effective bureaucratic tool.
How so?
Well, when you are processing millions of exams across vast distances, you need a way for examiners to grade them fairly, consistently, and rapidly. The rigid structure of the eight-legged essay provided exactly that. An examiner deeply accustomed to the format could read a paper and immediately assess the candidate's logical flow and their grasp of the canonical standards.
Just by checking if the structure held up.
Exactly.
So it radically reduced the subjectivity and uncertainty in grading.
It ensured a baseline standard of fairness. The goal of the imperial state for most of its history was not to foster rapid scientific innovation or disruption. The primary goal was to recruit loyal, morally upright, predictable administrators who shared a common linguistic and cultural framework.
They wanted officials who all spoke the exact same ideological language.
The eight-legged essay achieved that goal very effectively for centuries. It is a trade-off. You gain administrative uniformity and logistical ease in grading, but you systematically sacrifice cognitive diversity, adaptability, and practical problem-solving skills.
Knowing the immense complexity of what the candidates had to write is one thing. Understanding the physical and psychological torment of where they had to write it is an entirely different level of the story.
It is grim.
We have to examine the physical reality of the examination compounds.
The provincial examination compounds, known as Juchang, were vast, highly secured architectural complexes designed specifically to process thousands of candidates simultaneously.
The sources describe these facilities in stark detail. The candidates were placed in individual physical cells. These cells were arranged in incredibly long rows, and the rows were numbered according to the heavenly stems and earthly branches.
Which is an old indexing system.
Yeah, for the listener, think of the heavenly stems and earthly branches as an ancient Chinese alphanumeric grid system, like numbering spreadsheet rows A, B, C, and columns 1, 2, 3, but using ancient astrological markers. These individual cells were unimaginably small, approximately 1 meter wide by 2 meters deep.
They were essentially open-fronted brick booths. They provided no door for privacy and were completely open to the elements, the wind, the rain, the extreme heat, or the freezing cold.
And we mentioned the planks earlier.
Yes, the candidate was provided with a few simple wooden boards. These boards could be arranged across brick ledges to form a crude desk and a seat during the day, and then reconfigured into a makeshift cramped bed at night.
And the schedule was grueling. Candidates could be confined to these cells for up to 3 days and 2 nights per session, and there were often multiple sessions.
It was an endurance test.
They had to bring in all their own supplies: a water pitcher, a chamber pot, their own bedding, food that they prepared themselves over tiny charcoal stoves, and of course, their own inkstones and brushes.
The environment was designed strictly for maximum surveillance and security. As we discussed, the perceived integrity of the test was paramount. Before entering the compound, candidates underwent intense personal searches by guards to ensure they were not smuggling in any unauthorized materials.
The sources explicitly mention cheat sheets being found hidden in undergarments, woven into the soles of shoes, or hidden inside hollowed-out inkstones.
People were desperate.
And the punishments for this were severe. We are not just talking about getting a failing grade and being sent home. Cheating was considered a crime against the state. It could result in permanent exile or even public execution.
The intense security protocols, the deep isolation in the cells, the physical deprivation, the fear of the guards, all of it created an atmosphere of extreme psychological pressure.
Which brings us back to that grim detail from the introduction, which really underscores the severity of the environment. If a candidate succumbed to the elements, the stress, or an illness, and died inside their cell during the exam, the officials would not halt the exam.
No, the test continues.
They would not open the main gates to carry the body out, because opening the gates would compromise the security of the test. Instead, they wrapped the body in a straw mat and tossed it over the high walls of the compound.
It is a profound illustration of state priorities. It highlights how the machinery of the examination took absolute precedence over the individual human life. The psychological toll on the candidates was immense.
Because it wasn't just a test.
They were staking their entire family's financial future, their social standing, and generations of preparation on a few days of writing in a cramped, exposed cell.
To really illustrate the human experience of this, I want to share a narrative vignette directly from the sources. It was written by Pu Songling. He was a Qing Dynasty scholar and a famous satirist. He wrote Strange Tales from a Chinese Studio.
And crucially, he actually failed the higher-level examinations multiple times himself.
So he knew this misery firsthand. He wrote a piece detailing the seven likenesses of a candidate, and it captures the psychological breakdown of the process perfectly. Let me read how he describes the cycle.
His account provides profound insight into the cultural and emotional weight of the experience.
He writes, "When entering the examination hall, barefooted and carrying a basket, he is like a beggar. At roll call time, being shouted at by officials and abused by their subordinates, he is like a prisoner. When writing in his cell, with his head and feet sticking out of the booth, he is like a cold bee late in autumn."
The cold bee, yeah.
"Upon leaving the examination hall, being in a daze and seeing a changed universe, he is like a sick bird out of a cage. When anticipating the result, he is on pins and needles. At this point, he is like a chimpanzee in captivity."
It keeps escalating.
It does. "Finally, the messengers come on galloping horses and confirm the absence of his name. His complexion becomes ashen, and his body stiffens like a poisoned fly no longer able to move. Disappointed and discouraged, he is determined to abandon the world.
And then the reset happens.
With the passage of time, his anger subsides and his aspiration rises. Like a turtle dove just hatched, he rebuilds his nest and starts the process once again.
It is a devastatingly accurate portrayal of the psychological gauntlet, the cycle of physical degradation, the false hope, the paralysis of failure, and then the tragic reset, the turtle dove starting all over again because there is simply no other path to success in that society.
And that psychological pressure radiated outward, affecting entire families, villages, and communities. The anxiety produced by the examinations was so profound that it gave rise to a massive subculture of popular religion and divination.
When a system is this competitive, with a pass rate hovering around 1%, preparation and studying are often not enough to guarantee success. Candidates naturally turn to the supernatural to cope with the uncertainty and the immense pressure.
Looking for signs.
People relied heavily on fate to rationalize their chances in such an unforgiving marketplace. The sources note that there was a vast cultural literature concerning examination dreams, premonitions of success, interpreting the behavior of animals before a test.
Like trying to read tea leaves.
And specific temples that candidates and their families would visit to pray to deities of literature for favorable results.
It was not just China utilizing these intense methods either. To understand the sheer reach and the geopolitical influence of this system, we have to look at how neighboring nations adopted and adapted it.
The Chinese imperial examination model exerted a profound influence across East Asia. It served as a template for state building, centralization, and bureaucratic recruitment in several neighboring kingdoms.
Let us look specifically at Vietnam under the Led Dynasty. They adopted the examination system, but with their own regional adaptations. The sources mention specific requirements, like the mandatory composition of Tang-style regulated poems alongside the traditional essays on the Confucian classics.
They maintained the core focus on Confucian orthodoxy and literary skill, utilizing it to centralize their own administration, but they integrated it with their own cultural practices and literary traditions.
The physical setup was different, too. Instead of the massive walled compounds of permanent brick cells that we saw in China, Vietnamese candidates often used the lo chong, which were portable bamboo tents that the candidates were required to build themselves at the examination site.
It required a lot of self-reliance.
But the detail from the sources that really highlights the scale of this in Vietnam is the security protocol. Up until 1840, they used live elephants to guard the examination halls.
The deployment of elephants served a dual purpose for the Vietnamese state. Firstly, it highlighted the supreme importance, the majesty, and the prestige of the examinations to the general public.
A show of force.
Exactly. Secondly, it provided a very tangible, formidable deterrent against any attempt to disrupt the proceedings, riot, or facilitate coordinated cheating. It underscores how seriously these states took the integrity of their civil service recruitment.
Now, we have focused heavily on the civil side of the examinations, the scholars writing essays and poetry. But there was another track entirely that the sources detail, the military examination.
The state also needed a standardized mechanism for recruiting military officers, and they modeled it closely on the civil examination structure.
The military exams tested a completely different set of skills. The sources detail physical components like mounted archery, target archery, sword wielding, and brutal physical fitness tests like heavy stone lifting.
But it was not strictly physical.
Right. They also had a written component where candidates had to answer policy questions and demonstrate strategic knowledge based on texts like the Seven Military Classics.
It was an attempt by the administration to select officers who were proficient in both the martial and the civil arts leaders who understood both close combat and grand military strategy.
But here is where I want to push back on the logic of the empire. The sources consistently note that the military degrees were viewed as vastly inferior to the civil degrees in terms of social prestige.
They were, definitely.
The military candidates simply did not have the same respect. Why would an empire, which constantly needed to defend its massive borders from external threats, systematically devalue its military leadership track?
To understand that, you have to connect the policy to the broader philosophy of the state, which traces back to core Confucian values. The Confucian hierarchy fundamentally prioritizes the scholar over the soldier, the civil over the martial, harmony over violence.
Brains over brawn.
Yes. But it was also a very calculated, pragmatic political strategy. The imperial state, particularly from the Song Dynasty onwards, was deeply paranoid about regional military commanders gaining too much power.
Because of the warlord history.
Right. We discussed earlier how hereditary warlords fractured the empire in previous eras. By culturally elevating the civil examinations and ensuring that the most prestigious, powerful, and highest-paying positions in the central government were held exclusively by civil scholars, the state effectively subordinated military authority to civilian control,
keeping the generals in check.
The military exams existed to fill the ranks of the army, but the overarching cultural system was designed to prevent the rise of charismatic military strongmen who might turn their armies against the throne.
So, despite the grueling nature of the physical tests for the military track and the psychological torment of the civil track in those tiny cells, millions of people voluntarily submitted themselves to the system generation after generation.
Yes, they did.
The reason they endured it lies in the unparalleled rewards of the degree hierarchy.
The examination system created a highly structured, highly visible ladder of success. Climbing this ladder was the primary and often the only mechanism for significant social, economic, and political advancement in Imperial China.
Let us break down the journey up that ladder. It starts with the entry-level exams at the local level. A candidate who passed the county and prefectural tests became a tengsheng.
Right, a student.
If they continued and passed the academy exam, they achieved the status of shengyuan, or sikatai, which is a local licentiate.
Attaining the status of shengyuan was a monumental achievement for a family. It granted the individual official entry into the lower gentry class. They were no longer commoners.
Then, if they passed the highly competitive triennial provincial exam, they became a jurin, a recommended man. And if they made the long, expensive journey to the capital and passed the metropolitan and palace exams, they achieved the ultimate rank of jinshi, the advanced scholar.
And the absolute top performer overall was given the exclusive title of shuangyuan.
These titles were not just empty honorifics or certificates to hang on a wall. They carried profound, tangible, legal privileges that permanently altered the trajectory of a candidate's life and their family's standing.
The sources detail these perks, and they are massive. Tax exemptions, which for a land-owning family is a huge economic windfall.
It alone is huge.
Immunity from corporal punishment, meaning a local magistrate couldn't just order you to be beaten during a legal dispute. They received government rations, and they were legally entitled to wear specific official robes and buttons that visibly marked their elite status to everyone in society.
The privileges provided legal protection, profound economic security, and immense social prestige. It is no wonder that extended families and sometimes entire villages pooled their resources for generations to support a promising student.
It was an investment.
But we have to look at the raw numbers, because they paint a very stark picture of the reality of this system. By 1850, during the Qing Dynasty, China had a population of around 350 million people.
It was huge.
Out of that massive population, there were only about 800,000 civil licentiates across all levels. The pass rate for the higher exams was hovering around 1%.
The competition was unimaginably fierce. The system was processing millions of hopeful candidates, but only conferring degrees upon a microscopic fraction of the population.
This brings up the massive historical debate about true social mobility. The Kiju is often praised as the world's first great meritocracy, but I have to push back on that term.
Fair enough.
The sources point out that 90% of the population, the peasants, the artisans, the laborers, were effectively barred from participating. If 90% of the population cannot even afford to compete, calling this a meritocracy feels like a stretch. It feels like an aristocracy with extra steps.
It is a crucial nuance that challenges the modern definition of meritocracy. There was no public schooling system in the modern sense. To even attempt the exams, you had to achieve mastery of classical, non-vernacular Chinese texts. This required years, often decades, of intensive private tutoring.
You have to think about what it means to study the five classics. It is not just reading a book in your downtime. Someone has to work the agricultural fields while the candidate studies in the house. The family has to afford paper, ink, and a highly educated tutor.
Therefore, a massive educational barrier, a hidden curriculum of classical literacy existed. If your family could not afford to excuse you from agricultural labor and pay for a tutor, you were excluded from the system before you even took a test. The vast majority of the population was classically illiterate and therefore entirely ineligible.
However, the sources also present fascinating data showing that within the remaining 10% who could afford to compete, the system actually was highly mobile.
Yes, the mobility within that tier was real.
For instance, data from the Ming Dynasty indicates that 47% of successful upper-level candidates came from families with no prior degree holders in their immediate ancestry.
That is a highly significant statistic. It demonstrates that while the system was closed to the absolute bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, it did effectively prevent the formation of a closed, permanent aristocracy at the top. The elite class was constantly circulating.
Because failure had consequences.
Exactly. Families that held high office could lose their elite status within a single generation if their sons failed the exams. Conversely, a relatively modest merchant or wealthy landowning family could elevate themselves to the highest echelons of imperial power if they managed to produce a brilliant scholar.
Okay, but if only 1% pass, what happened to the millions who failed? Pu Songling didn't just disappear into the mountains as he threatened to in his satirical story. The sources highlight an unintended yet absolutely vital byproduct of the examinations.
The system generated a massive continual surplus of highly literate, classically educated men who dedicated their lives to studying but never achieved official government posts.
And these men became the cultural glue of the empire. They used their intense linguistic talents to find other roles. They became physicians. They became fiction writers like Pu Songling himself. They acted as local lineage agents managing community affairs.
And perhaps most importantly, they became the examination essay teachers for the next generation of candidates.
Keeping the cycle going.
Right. They managed local society and produced the vibrant culture of the era. They formed the bedrock of the local gentry class. Even without an official title, their classical education gave them immense authority in their local communities.
I want to point out a massive blind spot in this entire societal structure, though. We're talking about millions of candidates, but half the population is entirely missing from this narrative. Women were explicitly barred from taking the exams.
Yes. The formal institutional framework of the civil service was exclusively male. An unstated yet absolute gender ideology dictated that women were ineligible for official bureaucratic roles or state administration.
So if they could not take the test, how did women interact with this massive cultural phenomenon? Because you cannot have a system that dominates society without it affecting everyone. The sources suggest women still participated indirectly in the Kiju culture.
Women engaged with the examination system through the avenues available to them within the patriarchal structure of that society. They often followed their own rigorous educational pursuits, acquiring high levels of literacy, particularly in elite families.
They're reading the classics, too.
Definitely. And they participated in the culture by competing for spouses who were promising scholars or existing degree holders, which was a primary means of securing social standing for themselves and their extended families.
In raising the next generation.
Exactly. Mothers played a critical, recognized role in the early education and moral cultivation of their sons, preparing them for the intense rigors of the examination track. Their influence was indirect, but it was foundational to the continuous reproduction of the scholarly class.
For centuries, this sociocultural glue, the shared curriculum, the brutal cycle of exams, the resulting class of literati held the sprawling empire together. It provided stability. But as the world began to rapidly industrialize, the very thing that provided that stability, the rigid focus on ancient morality and structural conformity, became a fatal vulnerability.
It did.
This brings us to the 19th century, the delegitimation of the system, and the eventual fall of the Qing dynasty.
The 19th century delivered a series of profound, overlapping crises to the Qing Empire that violently exposed the limitations of an administration trained exclusively in poetry, ancient philology, and classical philosophy.
We see internal unrest on a massive scale, most notably the Taiping Rebellion, which lasted from 1850 to 1864. And there is an incredible irony here that the sources note. The Taiping rebels, who were trying to overthrow the king, instituted their own civil service examinations, but they based them on Christian texts rather than Confucian ones.
It demonstrates just how deeply ingrained the concept of an examination-based meritocracy was in the cultural psyche of China. Even revolutionaries seeking to utterly destroy the existing political order could not imagine governing without a standardized test to select their officials.
But the external threats were even more destabilizing. Western imperialism was forcing its way into China, bringing modern industrialized militaries, globalized economies, and entirely new diplomatic challenges.
And this is where the critiques of the traditional examination system became urgent and widespread. Reformists within China began to argue vehemently that the relentless focus on the eight-legged essay and the antiquity of the Confucian classics was actively stifling the nation's progress.
It was leaving them vulnerable to foreign powers.
Absolutely.
They realized that their high-ranking government officials were absolute masters of ancient morality and poetic meter, but they knew nothing about modern empirical science, mathematics, global geography, industrial engineering, or international law. You cannot fight a modern gunboat with a perfectly balanced essay.
The system that had brilliantly unified the empire and provided stability for a millennium was now producing leaders who were entirely ill-equipped to handle the complexities of the modern geopolitical landscape.
The skills didn't match the problems.
Right. The traditional forms of knowledge were increasingly viewed as inadequate and even derided as backward by the new generation of intellectuals who championed Western-style education and scientific inquiry.
This intense momentum for reform culminated in a sudden and drastic shift. In 1905, prominent political figures like Yuan Shikai and Zhang Zedong convinced the Qing court to abolish the imperial examination system entirely.
Just like that.
A 1,300-year-old institution was dismantled.
The speed of the abolition is what is truly remarkable. The reformists and the Qing court correctly summarized the educational problem and implemented a radical solution to modernize, but they fundamentally misunderstood the deep structural role the examinations played in holding their society together.
The sources point to this as a profound, fatal miscalculation. Explain why dismantling the exams, even if the curriculum was outdated, was such a fatal error for the Qing dynasty.
Well, the imperial examinations were not just a hiring mechanism for bureaucrats. They were the primary partnership, the fundamental social contract between the dynastic throne and the local elites spread across the vast empire. The examinations provided the gentry with their status, their legal privileges, and their defined pathway to power.
And in return?
In return, the gentry provided the dynasty with their loyalty, local governance, and societal stability.
By abolishing the exam so rapidly in favor of a new Western-style schooling system that hadn't even been fully built yet, the Qing court severed that vital bond.
Exactly. They unilaterally destroyed the only mechanism that validated the status of the local elites. The Manchu rulers of the Qing, in their desperate attempt to modernize and survive, gave up their most powerful weapon of cultural and political control. Once the examinations were gone, the traditional gentry who managed the provinces had no compelling reason to support the central dynasty.
The glue is gone, and the timing is undeniable. The examinations were abolished in 1905. Just a few years later, in 1911, the Qing dynasty fell, bringing an end to over two millennia of imperial rule in China. The fall of the examination system directly guaranteed the fall of the empire itself.
The reformers wildly underestimated the public reach and the deep structural integration of an institution that had taken previous dynasties centuries to build. They removed the keystone of the society, and the entire arch collapsed.
It is a staggering historical narrative. An empire engineered a massive standardized test to centralize power, used it to maintain incredible stability for over a millennium, and then inadvertently destroyed itself by turning off the very machine that kept it running.
But the cultural legacy of the Qiju did not die with the Qing dynasty. The physical cells were torn down, but the psychology remained.
No, it didn't die. Oh. The empire fell, but the deep cultural reverence for standardized meritocratic testing survived. It morphed. The ghost of the civil service examinations lives on today in the grueling college entrance exams that millions of students take. We see it not just in China with the modern Gaokao, but in various forms of high-stakes testing around the world. The mechanics changed, the curriculum modernized from Confucian texts to mathematics and science, but the fundamental belief that a grueling standardized test is the most legitimate, fair way to allocate opportunity and social status remains deeply embedded in how we organize society.
It raises fascinating, enduring questions about how we evaluate human potential and how we allocate leadership in any society.
It does. And that leads me to a final thought for you to ponder. The imperial examination system, for all its intense flaws, its rigidity, and its brutality, was built on a fundamental assumption. It assumed that deep moral education, a thorough grounding in philosophy and literature, automatically produced good, ethical, political leaders. Today, we have swung in the complete opposite direction. We often prioritize technical skill, specialized knowledge, and data management over philosophy or literature when selecting our leaders and executives. Have we perfected the art of selecting leaders with our modern technical metrics, or did the ancients understand something fundamental about the immense value of a shared moral curriculum that we have simply forgotten?
It is a profound question of what we value more in a leader when a crisis hits. Technical proficiency in a specific field, or a demonstrated commitment to a shared ethical and philosophical framework.
Something to mull over the next time you are faced with a standardized test. Thank you for listening. History Maps. learn history visually.